Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. You know the drill by now. Each week we visit with World War II veterans, and the idea really is threefold. We want to honor them for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories for posterity so these heroics are not forgotten. And maybe along the way, the rest of us can be inspired a little bit to love our country the way an entire generation of Americans did so many years ago. Today, we're going to visit with one Valley veteran who also has a few tales about a name that you will definitely know, a Hollywood star who wasn't just a token presence in the U.S. forces during World War II. He was a decorated veteran who would eventually retire as a major general. Which Hollywood star is that? We're going to find out as the program goes on. But first of all, let's meet the star of today's show, Foy Foster. He's going to be 90 years old in June. He lives in Fresno, California. But I guess growing up, you weren't anywhere near California. You were in the desert of Arizona, Casa Grande, Arizona. About how many people was that?
When I entered the Army, it was about 1,100 people.
A huge metropolis, Casa Grande, Arizona. So that's where you were on December 7th, 1941. What do you remember about that?
I was in Tucson at the University of Arizona, and it was, of course, on Sunday, and we were all listening to the music, and all of a sudden it broke out, the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor, and we were completely shocked and couldn't believe it. And right after that was over, I went down and enlisted because I was already subject to draft, and if I enlisted, I could go into the Air Force, which I wanted to.
I imagine that created quite a conversation between you and your buddies there at the University of Arizona. Probably a lot of guys did the same thing you did.
Yes, it was. My brother, who was in high school, had come down to spend the weekend with me there, and we were all in there, all in my in the lounge where we, in the rooming house where we were living, and they came on the air and announced that Pearl Harbor had been struck, and we were all draft age in the college. It was our second and third year of college, and so we were all concerned and knew that we had something really coming up.
You know, I'm thinking of people who are in their third year of college right now, and they probably don't want anything to interrupt what they're doing. They're focused on getting that degree and going on to a career. Obviously, you had a different frame of reference back then. Why was it so important for you to make that decision right away and to do something for your country?
Well, of course, like everyone else, when I was young, I was very overcome with patriotism, and I couldn't imagine our country being hit like that. So I felt right away, I'm going to go enlist. I don't want to stay any longer here because I'm going to go in eventually anyway, so I did.
So did you want to be a pilot? A lot of guys, when they enlisted in the Air Corps, say they wanted initially to be a pilot.
Yes, I did, but when I got in the Air Corps, they had classified me and sent me to bombardier school instead, not pilot.
And what was that like for you? What kinds of things did they teach you in bombardier school?
Well, first we had quite a few physics classes, and of course Morse code and meteorology, all the kind of weather things, then basic flight, why airplanes fly and all this, plus the fact that we had to do marching and drill and all this that was along with it.
And where were you doing all of this?
After basic training in San Antonio at Kelly Field, I was sent to Kirkland Field in Albuquerque, New Mexico, which was a bombardier school, and I went through there as a bombardier and graduated in October the 10th of 1942, and got my wings, bombardier wings, plus a second lieutenant.
And so you probably thought, okay, now I've got my wings, I'm a second lieutenant, and I'm going to get to go overseas and fly some missions here. And a lot of people don't know it. When you're on a bombing mission and that bomb run begins, the pilot's not in the control of the plane anymore. That falls to a guy like you. So that's a lot of responsibility, but you didn't get to exercise that responsibility just yet, did you? Where did they send you from there?
They immediately made me a bombing instructor for cadets, other cadets. And I did that for 6 months, I guess, and then I volunteered to go overseas because I was stationed in Demi, New Mexico, which was a little town in the middle of the desert, and I was 60,000 soldiers at the base, and we were all bored to death. So I said, I'm going over. So another friend and I, we volunteered with the next group and went from there to Boise, Idaho, which we thought we were leaving for overseas. But again, I was made an instructor of second lieutenants, flying in B-17s for bomb mission, practice bomb missions in B-17s. And I was an instructor there for quite a while until all of a sudden they formed a new bomb group, completely started it from scratch. I was one of the staff officers of bombing. I was chosen as bomb officer, squadron bombing officer for the 734th Squadron, which was part of my group, the 453rd Bomb Group. From then on, we trained our own crews that were assigned to us, complete crews. We trained them on bombing, on flight missions overseas. We'd been sent as staff officers to Orlando for the School of Applied Tactics, and which was all bombing, simulated bombing missions, complete missions that you did over there with simulated targets, and we learned how to do all that, plus all of us flying in formation, and we went back to teach our own crews that were assigned to our squadron.
Now, with all this training, all these simulated bomb runs, did you see those as valuable? Was that meaningful experience for you, or were you getting kind of tired of that and itching to go do some bombing runs for real?
Well, we were so busy, night and day, we were just so busy for about four months, I guess, teaching. And at the end, we finished with what we were doing with our crews, and then we were scheduled. And of course, we were anxious then to go, in a way to go, but yet scared also.
And while you were there, the 453rd Bomb Group was formed while you were there in Boise, Idaho. And this is where you met a man who you knew plenty about him, even if he didn't know you. Tell me about that first encounter and how you realized you were on the same base as somebody pretty famous.
Yes, I was a cadet stationed at Albuquerque, the last week we were flying for practice, I had to go up on a mission, two of us did, and one of us sat in the co-pilot seat. I was up there in the co-pilot seat, and we had a never knew who our pilot was going to be. And when we sit there, the pilot said something to me. I hadn't even glanced around. I was busy getting settled, and I realized that I recognized the voice immediately. It was Jimmy Stewart, the movie star, and I was completely flabbergasted. And we flew that mission, and he had just come into the service and was the first lieutenant, and he came in at that rate because he had been flying, had many hours, thousands of hours in huge planes back in Hollywood on his own, and he was very nervous because he kept punching me all the time. What? Look up there for the plane. Watch for planes. Watch. But that's all the experience I had with him there at Albuquerque.
So I was wrong. I said Boise. You actually met him before that at Albuquerque. And this is not a situation where you realized after the war that he was a big shot. He was a big star then. He had already made some of the movies that people know him for, like Philadelphia Story, You Can't Take It With You, some of those major films that he had already starred in. So I imagine this probably became the pretty hot topic around that base that Jimmy Stewart was there.
From when I left the Albuquerque and was sent to Boise, I got up there, and who but Jimmy Stewart was our, he was still the first lieutenant, and he was an operations officer, and he was in charge of everything, and he signed my pass to let me go out from 8 o'clock at night till 2 a.m., and I have the pass signed.
I see that pass, and I'll post a picture of it on our website, kmjnow.com, and I have to ask, why is that written in pencil? I think there's a reason for that, isn't there?
We all use pencils in the Air Corps because if you use the fountain pen, ballpoint pens were not invented yet. Right. So fountain pens had the tube full of ink, and if you went in an airplane up and came down in the pressure would squeeze the ink all over your shirt. And it was usually indelible, and your shirt was ruined. So we never carried pens.
But you didn't learn that the hard way, right? Someone else learned it the hard way for you.
I learned it the hard way. I ruined a uniform shirt.
And you probably had to pay for a new shirt, right?
Yeah, we had to buy our own uniform, the officers did. Although they gave us an allowance to help buy it.
So you did learn the hard way, and you wouldn't make that mistake twice. And, you know, in terms of Jimmy Stewart, and I know you're going to have some more stories for us, but for those who don't know, and Foy gave you a little bit of the background of Jimmy Stewart, he was so serious about serving in the war. Both of his grandfathers had served in the Civil War. His father served in the Spanish-American War and World War I. He had his pilot's license 6 years before the war, was drafted in 1940, but was too skinny. He wasn't heavy enough, so he put on some weight to finally get in. He even filmed a propaganda film for the U.S. military, helping them get 150,000 recruits to the Air Corps. And then he actually was a B-24 pilot, a very decorated pilot. He won the Distinguished Flying Cross, the Croix de Guerre, and kept flying throughout his career. Even long after World War II, he remained in the reserve. He actually flew a B-52 in Vietnam and didn't want anybody to know about it. I mean, here's a guy who was pretty serious about serving his country.
Oh, yes, overseas. When I got overseas and the first mission we went on, our group operation officer, the plane went down with them on it, and they brought in a new one, and it was Lieutenant Colonel Jimmy Stewart as our new operations officer. So everywhere I went, just by chance, I went with wherever Jimmy Stewart was. And while we were stationed there, two of us by chance were chosen as partners. And we had to serve time all night down at the headquarters waiting for the teletype to come from General Eisenhower's headquarters to tell us about the next day's mission, what the feather would be, where the flak and where the planes would be, what bomb load to take, and all this. And often we'd have to sit there all night sometimes because the weather was so bad there wouldn't be any. But Jimmy and I got pretty, Colonel Stewart and I got pretty friendly. He told me a few things about Hollywood he wouldn't discuss with anybody else or anyone because we were there alone. And one night he was reading the paper and he started laughing. I said, "What are you laughing about?" He said, "I see they drafted that little imp for Mickey Rooney," said, "I hope they pour it to him." He didn't care for Mickey.
That's pretty funny. And there are some great stories about all the different Hollywood actors who served in World War II. I'm curious, with him in particular, and you said that the first time you heard his voice in the cockpit, you knew it was him. Mr. Smith Goes to Washington was another movie it just made just before the war. And what I'm curious about is if you or any of the other flyers tried to impersonate his voice, because he had such a distinctive voice, Jimmy Stewart, you know. And did you ever, behind his back or to his face, try to sound like him?
No, not. But the thing is that before D-Day came in June of 44, for 2 months we had to carry a 45 pistol at our hip and carry our gas mask with us everywhere we went because we didn't know whether Hitler would come at us before the invasion was. So on June the 5th, 1944, which was my birthday, they called us, rang the thing, and called us out to form by the hangars, and we all lined up in formation in the whole base. And then Jimmy Stewart came to the microphone, and he said, in that voice that I'll never forget, he said, "Boys, this is it. D-Day begins tonight at midnight." And it did.
So, I mean, you talk about living a movie, and you're part of a very historic undertaking, but here you are with the movie star giving you the exhortation to go get him. That had to be pretty inspiring or pretty exciting for the rest of you when you see him up there as the example.
We all respected Jimmy Stewart because he flew all of his missions and just like everybody else. He took all the flak that hit his plane and all the bombers, all the fighters, just like all of us. And we never discussed his Hollywood career with him at the officers' club or any place because he didn't want to even talk about it. He wanted to be considered just one of the right guys. So that's what we did. I happened to be, because I was with him at night, all night long, about 2 weeks, that we became to talk a little bit about it. But I promised I wouldn't mention it to anybody else. until now.
Well, the statute of limitations is up, and Jimmy Stewart passed away back in 1997, but what a proud legacy. In addition to all those films, his terrific service to our country during World War II. And I'm curious, as we wrap up the Jimmy Stewart discussion here, I have to imagine that the rest of his career, when he released some of these famous movies, and do you know what the first movie he was in after the war happened to be?
It was a Western movie, but I can't remember what it was. I saw all of them, though. I saw all of them before, and I was very impressed with Marlene Dietrich having the catfight with another woman in Destry Rides Again.
Never got to ask him about that one. As far as my research, it said that the first movie he made after World War II was It's a Wonderful Life, which obviously is still one of the classics. He had worked with Frank Capra before in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. And so if Jimmy Stewart hadn't survived all these bombing missions in Europe in World War II, it would have been someone else playing the character George Bailey in It's a Wonderful Life. That's kind of hard to imagine, isn't it? And that was the whole plot of the movie.
Right. The thing that was strange to me, seeing him in person, Lieutenant Colonel Stewart was so skinny. He was so tall and thin, and the seat of his pants hung down to his knees in the back. But he was really a good guy. And when we would go down to the officers' club at night, he would sit and play the piano with all the popular tunes at that time. And he loved to play the piano. And we'd sit and listen to him and talk to him.
What a guy, Jimmy Stewart. Well, this program is not so much about Jimmy Stewart, although that's been a fun detour, but about Foy Foster. He's going to be 90 in June. He lives in Fresno, California, and he flew 35 missions as a bombardier on B-24s with the 453rd Bomb Group. We're going to hear about some of those missions when we come back, and if Foy has some other Jimmy Stewart stories to throw in there, we'll allow that as well. You're listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Your mouth's bleeding. Are you sure you're all right?
My mouth's bleeding, Bert! My mouth's bleeding! Do those pedals. There they are! Bert! What do you know about that? Merry Christmas!
Well, you recognize that voice, don't you? That's Jimmy Stewart. We've been talking about him on today's edition of Hometown Heroes because our guest today, Foy Foster, served with him in the 453rd Bomb Group during World War II. If you'd like to read more about what Jimmy Stewart did during World War II, you can go to our website, kmjnow.com, and you'll also see the signed pass that Foy Foster still has with James Stewart's signature on it. He was his officer there in Boise, Idaho at the time. But let's continue now with the 453rd Bomb Group. You're deployed overseas. You know you're going to be a bombardier on a B-24. Now, and you flew most or all of your missions in the same airplane. Tell me about that airplane and where the nose art came from.
It was the B-24. Our original plane was the War Bride, which Our pilot, who was we all really liked, had just gotten married a few days before we came overseas, so we named it in honor of his war bride.
Well, that was certainly fitting. Tell me about that journey over, because here you'd been in the States, you'd done all this training, you're kind of itching to go over there, you finally get to go. What was that like for you, going from the United States over to Europe, to England, and getting ready to fly?
We didn't know when we flew our planes from March Field at Riverside down to West Palm Beach, Florida, all the way across, stopping at various bases on the way. And then we didn't know where we were going to go. We didn't know where we were going to Europe or we were going to Asia. We didn't know that until we were 2 hours after we took off on our way. Then we were allowed to open our orders. And we were happy we were going to Europe, to 8th Air Force, instead of to Japan because of the islands and that. We were happy. If we had to be sent somewhere, it was England. And when we got our orders to take off, we all went down in our plane, and we lined up with our planes in a long line on the ramp to take off one at a time. And as we just as the plane right ahead, right in front of us, took off and got into the air, and then it right in front of our faces, it blew up and caught fire and fell right square. And we knew who the crew was. He was one of our crews, and I knew the bombardier on there very well. But we didn't know what had happened because we flew from there on to Puerto Rico and landed there for overnight or two nights. And we asked the other crews what happened, and they said Ray Cardenas, he was from Puerto Rico, and he was going to call his parents, unbeknown to the, but he was walking around, and his skin was like burnt cowhide, and he died. The whole crew died from fire, and that was our baptism on our way overseas.
Well, that strikes me as being a little unnerving, a little intimidating, that without any kind of enemy fire or any opposition, you're flying something that can just go up in smoke just like that.
Right. We don't know why it blew up, but it did. Maybe the oxygen caught fire or something, but it blew up. And then we went on from there to Puerto Rico and stayed there, and then flew from there. All of us were flying as a group, not in formation, but in our planes. And we landed in British Guiana. From there, we went to Belém in the middle of the jungle in South America, in Brazil, down by the Amazon. And it was absolutely cut out of the jungle. It was at night. We wondered at our barracks, they had the iron beds with coffee cans of water at the bottom, and we wondered what it was. Well, that night we found, because the walls were completely covered and the floors with worms about 1 foot long and about as big around your finger, they were coming out of the jungle there at night. And then at morning they disappeared, but we were really shocked. It was like a nightmare.
Couldn't get out of there fast enough, huh?
No. And then we went from there to Natal, which is on the bulge of Brazil, pointing towards Africa. And before we left, when we arrived at this Belém in the jungle, it was the 23rd of December, and we were all homesick for Christmas and concerned about going over a little bit about going. We didn't know what was ahead for us. And then my friend, other bombardier's name was Bert Ignoli. I asked him if he wanted to go to Midnight Mass, and he said yes. So we went to Midnight Mass, and right in the middle of the Mass, some enlisted man that had been stationed in that jungle hole for so long went completely berserk, and he was screaming and yelling and went forward and tried to kill the priest. At least that's what he said, I'm going to kill you. So then they subdued him and took him away, but we were all shook up. All shook up that night on Christmas Eve because that happened.
So it seems like everywhere you turned, there was a reason to not be too encouraged or enthused about doing what you were doing.
It seemed that way, too. I don't know what had happened to everybody or not, but for some reason, everywhere we went, that's what happened to us. And then we stayed for about a week in Natal on the bulge of Brazil sticking out. We didn't know, they had to wait until the weather was good to cross the ocean over to Africa. And so when the weather finally got okay, they called us, came and got us up at 4 o'clock in the morning and said, you're scheduled to go, individual plane to go. I found later the enlisted men, one of the men, radio operator I think it was, got drunk and had passed out, so his buddies carried him on the plane and laid him down, and he passed out in South America and woke up in Africa, and he was completely out, completely confused.
I don't blame him. Talk about continental shift on that one for him. So you get to North Africa, and then from there on into England. And by February of 1944, it's time for your first mission as a bombardier in a real mission with a real target. What do you remember about that?
I remember that, of course, as soon as we got there, we flew the first mission in about 2 days after we arrived. We didn't waste any time. And we went somewhere in France. I can't remember now. It's a long, it wasn't way down. It wasn't a very long mission, but we went somewhere in France to bomb some installation. And of course, it was all new, and we didn't know yet what was ahead of us. But
was there, from what I read, it was Tours, which was the first target for your group. I'm curious about you personally. After all the training you'd been through and all the buildup to this moment, was there some adrenaline pumping for you? And tell us, as the bombardier on a B-24 with a target, what are your responsibilities? How does that mission unfold for you as the bombardier?
Well, you put the bomb site, the Sperry bomb site, which was a very new and very secret thing, and very wonderful. You could at 35,000 feet, you could practically drop a bomb in a pickle barrel, because you could cross the airs and move and hold it down. And while you were flying, you had it all on automatic pilot, usually, unless the weather was so bad and jumpy you couldn't. Then you controlled it in to set the bomb site where the speed and the airspeed and all and the wind and all this to get it to hone in and then drop it. And you were busy with that, with your controls and watching that. You couldn't think of anything else at the time. And it wasn't so bad that first mission, but later, as we went deeper into Germany, we had flak coming up, anti-aircraft guns. You could see it ahead, puffs of smoke where they burst in the air and sent pieces of metal flying in every direction. We were scared to death of it. And plus, the German planes were coming, fighter planes were coming in. So we really, every minute, we were all the time we were over Nazi Germany, we were ever tense and on alert all the time we were in the air. When we did come back home, we were exhausted, completely, completely exhausted.
And I'm curious, too. I've talked to guys who were Marines or infantry soldiers, and the first time they were confronted with an enemy, you know, face-to-face, and it was either him or the other guy that was going to get it, that was a tough moment to get over emotionally. For you, as someone with your finger on the controls of this destructive force, the bombs that are going to wipe out, you know, military targets in theory, but you know there's a human cost to that. How did you reconcile that? How did your thought process work to be able to do that, to perform your job when it probably wasn't easy?
We didn't think of the people that might be down there. We wouldn't even consider that. We thought only of the target, like an airplane factory, or parts for an airplane, or parts for machine guns and all that. We thought of those. We didn't try to think about it, although I know that one mission we went on, and I felt so bad about that, all of us did. They sent us to the so-called West Point of Germany, and we dropped incendiary bombs on a graduating class, which I didn't think was right, but we did anyway. That's how we were sent. That was one way of getting the Nazis under control.
And as far as what you know about what damage your bombs produce, did you have cameras taking pictures on your plane? How would you know whether or not a mission like that or any other mission was actually successful?
We had cameras taking pictures of the beginning of the run all the way through. And as it hit, it pinpointed the smoke when the bombs hit. And we could see how close we were. As long as we were in a good vicinity of it, it destroyed the target was good. Our biggest problem was we didn't have radar in those days, and if we had a heavy overcast, we had a hard time. In fact, a couple of missions we had to abort and come back. We didn't even drop our bomb because it was so heavy overcast unexpectedly that we couldn't even see the targets.
I know there are a lot of stories here to come, and I don't want to gloss over anything, but you mentioned D-Day and the speech that Jimmy Stewart gave to your bomb group right before you guys left for there. But what do you remember about that time around D-Day? What kind of targets did you hit? And I imagine you had to see some pretty impressive movements of ships at sea, of forces on the ground. This had to be somewhat spectacular to behold everything that was going on.
When Jimmy Stewart announced, "Boys, this is it, that D-Day begins tonight at midnight," that was on June the 5th, about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. we immediately went to and had our evening meal, and then we had to gear up and take off by midnight on June the 5th. We took off at midnight for bombing at daybreak, and the reason we had to do that because we had to fly around all over England trying to find our own formation. Our leader was there, and we all had to form on him. And the leaders all sent out flares of different colors, and we had to look for that color to get in formation with the rest of our group. There were planes everywhere you could look. Looked like a flock of birds, B-24s everywhere. And we got in formation, and then we just flew in formation all around and around over England until daybreak. Then at daybreak, we took off for the continent. And when you look down at the ocean, you couldn't see the water for boats. They had boats of every kind. British civilian boats, sailboats, anything that motors, anything they could get. You could walk from England all the way to France, stepping on one boat after another. And then, of course, as we flew, our first mission was to drop bombs on the German army that was lined up along the coast, and we dropped it on their installations. And then we flew back to England, loaded up again, and flew back again to the same place. Then back to England, loaded again, went back, and they gave us some sort of amphetamines. We'd never heard of them before then, but we were all so exhausted that they gave us that to keep us awake, keep us going. And so we flew, that first day, we flew three missions over, dropping on the Germans.
Three round trips from East Anglia, England, to the coast of France to bomb the Germans. So what time did you finally get back on that third round trip and get to settle into your bed?
Well, we did it all in the morning because we got there at daybreak. So we were back, I guess, about somewhere around 11 or 12 or something, and went to bed.
But you had taken off at midnight, so you're absolutely exhausted, I'm sure.
12 hours are we up there. And we, of course, our B-24s were not pressurized. They were open. In fact, the B-24, as everybody, I think, knows, was originally designed as a cargo ship. And they converted it as quickly as they could into a bomber. And they added the nose turret up in the front, and it never fit exactly. So the wind would blow through the nose turret, through the sides, and go through the plane. And, of course, when we were overseas, over the bombing mission, the gunners on the side had to take the windows off and fire from the open windows. So there was cold air going through. And we called them whistling privies, only that was not what we called it overseas. But that's what we called our liberator, because it was nothing but cold air flying. You were freezing to death.
Some great memories that Foy Foster has of his time with the 453rd Bomb Group in World War II. We're going to take another break. And when we come back, we're going to hear about more of his 35 missions, the fateful mission that he did not take part on, and why that is crucial to him being here to talk to us today. Many more memories to come from Foy Foster. Going to be 90 years old in June. Our guest today on Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. As usual, the time goes by very fast when we're reminiscing about time in World War II. Foy Foster spent plenty of time in the U.S. Army Air Corps. He was a bombardier in a B-24 with the 453rd Bomb Group, the 734th Bomb Squadron. I read that one of the records of World War II flights was held by one of the other squadrons in your bomb group. The 733rd flew 82 missions without a single loss. Unfortunately, your squadron was not that fortunate. And sometimes when you look back, you realize everything happens for a reason. And in your case, at one point, the flight surgeon had to ground you. You could not fly missions as a bombardier. What happened there? Why were you grounded?
I was all dressed along with my crew, and we went down for the briefing. and I was sneezing and coughing, and the flight surgeon was, our squadron flight surgeon was there, and he said, Foy, I'm going to ground you because you've got too bad a cold. You can't go up that high altitude. So they substitute somebody else in my place, and I went on back to the barracks, and I was undressing and alone in the barracks, undressing, and I heard this loud explosion. Well, I learned later it was my crew that I was supposed to be with. They got so high in the air, and then the plane settled and came back down and hit the ground, and it blew up, and all the bombs for some reason exploded too. And there was nothing left of anything except a little piece of red hair skull, which we knew was our co-pilot who was red-headed. That's all that was ever found of anybody. And if I hadn't been grounded, I would have been right there on the crew. And I had a lot to think about and to be thankful for, but sad to miss the ones that, my crew members, my buddies.
How did that hit you? Because that is a lot to wrap your brain around when you're a 23-year-old kid, and here these are the guys that you've grown to know the best out of everybody, putting your lives on the line together all the time, and they die on the one mission that you're not on. How did you deal with that?
It was hard to take because when you're with your buddies overseas during the war, they become your family. You don't have any family. None of you do. They're all thousands of miles away and only a memory. So the ones that you're with and sharing all the things and going through that, we become very close buddies, very close friends, more so than any other time. So when you have a loss like that, it was really hard to take. It hurt so bad. And it not only that, there was mission after mission I flew on where I would look out the side of the plane and see one of the planes in our formation, and we all knew whose plane was which and where they were. So we'd see their plane on fire and see the with the open windows on the side, them trying to fight the fire with the extinguishers. And then you'd see them sometimes blow up right in the air, all of them, your friends and that. And you'd see them going down, spinning in a great big circle, going down to, and you know they were gone and hoped that they could get out of the plane. But so it hurt all of it there because we were all close friends, and we got to be in our barracks. We lived in Quonset huts, and we were, my crew and the ones I was with was down at one end of the Quonset hut, and the new crew, replacement crews coming over, would be at the other end. We got to where we wouldn't even try to be friends with the new crew. We didn't want to be friends with them because almost four or five times after the new crew arrived in our barracks, they went down on the first few missions and never heard of them again, and we didn't want to become friends with them because if you don't know them and don't know anything about them, it doesn't hurt you when you're there. So that was a terrible thing to have to do, to ignore them as much as possible and only talk to them a little bit because several of us didn't want to be friends with them because we knew if they go down, we'll feel bad about it because it had happened.
Just the realities of war. I have to ask you, in seeing things like that, witnessing the death and devastation, did it ever make you afraid to go on your next mission?
We were scared to death on every mission. We were scared and we were homesick. But that's one thing we never told any of our buddies. We would not tell each other we were scared, but we were all scared on each mission because you didn't know, anytime you took off, you didn't know whether that would be your last one or not.
And you didn't make friends with the other crews, but after your crew was killed in that crash, you would join another crew. And there's a pretty good story there, too. What a small world it is. You told us you were from a town of 1,100 in Arizona called Casa Grande, and apparently you weren't the only one in the Air Corps to know Casa Grande as a hometown.
Yes, when I was assigned to the new crew after mine crashed, I went out to meet them and get ready to fly the first mission with them, and I was so surprised to discover that the co-pilot on the crew was Bob Eisenbach from my hometown in Casa Grande. We grew up in that little 1,100 people in that little cotton town in Arizona. And here we met and our crew members over in England, thousands of miles away.
Talk about a small world. So you would fly more missions with that crew, and you guys were part of some of the significant actions in Europe, bombing German communication lines during the Battle of the Bulge, ferrying cargo, hauling gasoline, rations, blankets to France, dropping ammunition and medical supplies later as Allied forces crossed the Rhine in March of 45. And you got to come home before it was all said and done in Europe. You got to 35 missions, and they said, okay, we've had enough of you for now. What did it mean to you to be able to come back to America? Did you feel bad leaving some of those guys there in Europe still fighting, or were you just relieved to get home?
I hated to leave them. I hated to leave, but I was also happy to be able to come home. And they sent us, I've forgotten the name of the town, and we came home on a Kaiser Liberty ship, which was a small ship that when the waves took it, the bow up in the air, you would rise there, and when it would go down the other way, you could hear the propeller spinning in the air because it was such a small ship. It made so quickly over there. And when we came back and landed at Charleston, South Carolina, and I remember some of the guys, we had tears in their eyes, and they ran and they fell down on the ground and kissed the ground. They were so happy to get home.
And what about you? Do you remember what it felt like when you saw your family again for the first time since going over?
Yes, I finally got to see my mother. My mother and dad were divorced. I saw my mother in Houston, Texas. They sent me first to Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio when I came up after I left Charleston, came there by train. And then later I got to go and see my dad down in Casa Grande and visit with him. I was happy as I could be to see him, because I didn't think when I went overseas, had a feeling that I may never see him again.
I'm sure they had the same feeling, and there are probably a few prayers uttered over those few years. When you look back on all of it, everything that you experienced in the Army Air Corps in World War II, the close calls, all the flak, having your complete crew lost on a mission that you weren't on, and if you had been on that mission, there are two kids and three grandkids who would never have been born. When you look back on it, what are you most thankful for? What are you most proud of? What means the most to you all these years later?
I'm glad that I got back, glad that I was there, but I thought of all the others I left, and there was one mission I didn't tell you about. One mission that we flew in the Iraq War and the Desert Storm War, they talked about friendly killing American soldiers with friendly fire. But let me tell you something about friendly fire that never got in the papers. We were scheduled to fly with our crew, our missions, all of our planes, all the way across Germany down to the very southern base to an airplane factory down there, almost to the Swiss border. And when we got the briefing to go, we were told that we would have a tailwind blowing us back, and we would have no trouble getting back when we were at the time that we were supposed to. But when we started back, instead of a tailwind, we had a headwind. So that when we arrived over England, it was after dark. And that was very, very bad, because the British planes couldn't fly as high as we could with the B-24s, so they flew at night, but we flew in the daytime. So when we came back over England after dark, the English thought we were German bombers, and they were shooting anti-aircraft at us. The English fighters were shooting, coming and knocking us, some of us down. And then the German fighters followed in and started in on us. So all the time we were flying over England, we were being attacked and shot, and we lost more planes over England than we did over all of Germany. And when we got ready to land, they said, they'll only flash the lights for just a minute because the Germans are strafing everything. So they would flash it, and we came in and landed, and they said, get away from your plane, they're strafing the planes. So we flew as fast as we could along the ramp and got out and ran for the bomb shelter because they were strafing, the German fighters were. So we lost more planes and more Americans over that mission than we ever did on any mission over England, but it was a mistake. It was something that didn't know that the wind would change and cause that. But it was, again, a case of friendly fire, our allies shooting us down, which they didn't know they had every right to think they were being attacked by German bombers at night.
Oh, it's amazing how the smallest details can have the most significant implications. And what a tragic story that is. And I'm guessing you probably never ran faster in your life than you did away from that B-24.
Oh, yes. We took off as fast as we could and dove into the bomb shelter. Stayed there until they gave a signal to come out.
Well, Foy, we're just about out of time. I want to thank you for serving our country and for sharing some of those memories with us. Is there anything else about your time in World War II that you'd like to share with our audience?
I don't think so. I think I've talked an awful lot.
Well, everyone's been on the edge of their seats listening intently. Foy Foster of Fresno, California has been our guest today. If you want to see what he looks like, learn more about his story, you can go to our website, kmjnow.com. And we'll be back next Saturday with a Mother's Day edition of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.